Welcome to From the Rooftop Music Podcast, a production of Rooftop Music Rehearsal and Recording Studio, located in beautiful downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today's podcast is titled Break It Down and Anatomize, and what we're breaking down today is music. A few weeks ago, I was listening to some music while working and started thinking about why I really liked the song that was playing. It wasn't a particularly great song. It's called After the Fall by Journey. Kind of a cheesy ballad, but since I'm a sucker for a great rhythm section, and I think Journey had one of the best, and a fantastic guitarist, Neil Sean, is one of my favorites, I realized there are many reasons why I like this song. So I thought I'd bring a few people together and anatomize some music and get into why you like a song. My name is Tony Perry. I'm a local musician, owner of Rooftop Music Rehearsal and Recording Studio. Today, my guests are Matthew Mayer, local musician in one of the bands I'm in, Brian Stone, also a local musician and local music podcaster who hosts the show Stone on Air here in the Chattanooga metro area. I also have Todd Scotchtepole, a great friend of mine going back decades, who I respect tremendously. And when it comes to music taste and knowledge of the art of music in general, Todd is way high up there on my list. So guys, thank you for joining. Here's how it's going to work today. I've got some tunes you guys picked out. I'm going to pull them up one at a time. We'll listen to a little bit of them and then just start talking about why you selected these songs to analyze and then anatomize it. Everybody can comment on them. So the first one is one of Matt's songs, one of my favorites, a good old time special called Good Time, Bad Times by Led Zeppelin. I'm going to share a little bit of that now. So Matt, one of your tunes, tell me, please. I'm just dying to hear why you love this song, because I know why I love it.
So with this is what I really, if I'm truly being honest, launched my desire to play guitar. So I'm 10 years old. It's 1980 when I bought this on cassette with some Christmas money. It's the second cassette I owned. I got the Cars first album that Christmas or first cassette, and I had Christmas money, and I went and I bought this album because of the cover. Now, with the, you know, the blimp blowing up over the Hindenburg, that's first song. So that hit me, and all of a sudden it was literally the most amazing thing I had ever heard. So I know a lot of guitar players my age will tell you, Smoke on the Water or, you know, Eruption or Iron Man, you know, all fine tunes. But this, especially, I think it's around the 129 mark where he hits that solo. I was just like, this is the most amazing thing I ever heard. I need to learn how to do that.
That's awesome. What do you guys think, Brian, Todd?
Well, I'll say, Matt, as you were mentioning, as far as a song to learn as a young, you hear something, you want to learn it. And it one songs that are popular, as you were mentioning, you said, Smoke in the Water. And then whatever the next one is, in my head, I was thinking an Iron Man. And then you said, right. Iron Man.
Yep.
So, cause that falls right into that category of, well, I think I can do that. Like it's, right. it's not that it's simple or simplistic, but it is, it's so recognizable, and it's, you can easily show somebody quickly, hey, look what I learned, without having to explain it too much, as long as you have a little bit of skill level. So I got a kick at you saying Iron Man, cause that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yes. Yes. That's what it is. And that, like I said, those are the, but this, yeah, Just loved it. To this day, I still love it.
Yeah, that Deep Purple album was one that had Smoke on the Water was one of my first albums. And, you know, it was more than just Smoke on the Water. It was a lot of the songs. Bass Truckin'.
Machine Head.
Yeah. And
Maybe I'm Leah. It's my favorite song off that album.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, when I go ahead, Todd, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and then that Black Sabbath was another one of my early ones. And Grand Funk Railroad, you know, that that yellow disc. We're an American band, yeah.
One of the first concerts I ever went to, I was thinking I was about 11 or 12 years old, was Grand Funk Railroad, and that show just, those guys just blew my mind. But I think about Good Times, Bad Times, Matt, and I think about how that music, how that song just grabs you at the beginning. You know, it's like, I can just only imagine the first time, somebody heard them, maybe in a high school auditorium or something, you know, or a very small club with 20 people in it, and they come out and they just ban out, you know, and it's, people are like, well, what the hell is this? Who are these guys? What are these guys all about?
So think about it. This is something that gets missed in this day and age. And I don't want to talk about nostalgia. And I'm really not a big fan of that, but you got to imagine this. I'm 10 years old. I have this little GE cassette player. You got to hit it. I unwrap the cassette, I open it, I snap it in, and I hit play, and I got this one little, probably 6, maybe 8-inch speaker if I'm lucky. And that's what I hear coming out of it.
That's awesome.
You know, 10 years old, 1980, sitting there in Tom's River, New Jersey. You're just like, ba-da. I'm like, what am I listening to?
So Matt, I'm curious, what made you buy it? Did somebody
cover.
Say do it?
The absolute cover. I went to the rock section, and honestly, it was the coolest cover. And I knew Led Zeppelin was a cool band because all the older kids in my neighborhood walked around with Led Zeppelin shirts, and that's what the cool kids listened to. And awesome. So I'm like, this is the coolest cover. Everybody, you know.
So yours is part memory. You know, why you love this song is part memory. It takes you back to a particular time, but also part, the anatomy of this song that grabs you at the beginning and carries you through the tune. And then you get to the lead part and the lead just blows you away.
Yeah, it launched it. I had to go listen
to the end.
Yeah, after that, I had to find out what the heck else was really out there other than, you know, in my world, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, I'm in my mom's car. And all she's listening to is the local, what they call WOBM was the station. And it's basically now what is known as yacht rock today.
Right.
But that's what it played. You know, I live in a little beach community. I grew up in a beach community. So my mom's stuff at the time, well, I love yacht rock now, but at the time, boring, not cool.
Yeah. Well, and as you're saying, Matt, it was around 1980. Good Times, Bad Times, that's like a 2.5 minute song. And by the time we're getting to that time frame, the longer form songs are taking over more. They've moved away from the Beatles and the 60s and early 70s. Keep everything fast, fast, fast. Move along. Bohemian Rhapsody. I don't know what year it came out, but like those kinds of things starting to creeping into the popular conscience, but then that's still that quick, just boom, boom, boom. Almost, it's not punk rock, but it's got punk rock sensibilities to it, right? You know, just rock and get right to it. So,
that
was good for a young person's attention span, I would guess.
Yeah. That's a great saying, Brian. Rock and get right to it. You know, and perfect example of that is Good Times, Bad Times.
Yeah. So I take it, Matt, you didn't have any older brothers to introduce to it. Because I had an older sister, but she was more into the Simon and Garfunkel and the Carole Kings and, you know, those. And so I was introduced to it myself, too. And I, you know, kind of did it looking at the album covers. You know, we had one store called The Turntable, and I'd go down there and I'd just look at the album covers, you know.
That's an interesting thing. Yeah. So, I'm the oldest. I had older cousins that I'd go visit. They lived up in Bergen County, and we'd go up there twice a year, and I idolized them. And You know, they were also big into, they had everything. They had an album collection, Zeppelin, Priest, Maiden, Sabbath, Stones. They had it all. Like, and I just, again, just wanted to be cool.
Yeah, I think about my influences and my brother, my oldest brother. I'm the youngest of seven, and I have a brother that's in his 80s. I have another brother that's in his mid-70s. But the one in the mid-70s had this fantastic music collection, and he was into everything, really. The Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Stones. I used to listen to his Beatles albums on this little Radio Shack stereo that the speakers detached, and I'd lay their speakers on the floor in our music room, and I'd lay on the floor, and one speaker would be here and the other speaker would be there, and I'd crank up the Beatles. That was like my first induction into loud music directly into my ears. Was doing that on this old realistic tune table. But my brother, older brothers, like your sister, Todd, introduced me to music at a very early age, probably 9 or 10 years old.
Is that what we get to hear from you, Todd? Did you pick one of the songs your older sister introduced you to?
No, actually, I went a different direction on this one. The one I picked out came out, I think, 89 or 90. So,
all right, well, let's go to that. Good segue, Matt. This one is going to be Todd's selection, which is Indigo Girls, Closer to Fine.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger.
I love that song.
Yeah. Yeah. So just a little background that, you know, Tony first asked me to get on here. I said, sure, I'd love music. As you say, Tony would come and he'd play his guitar and we'd sing along, or we'd just randomly pick out songs off of our playlist and play them for each other. Ones, bands we probably didn't know each other, you know, that we didn't know, introducing new things. I'm not a musician. Early age, I can't sing. I was told no musical ability. So I come at it from a little bit different perspective. And so it was hard for me to narrow down songs. But the highest level, I thought of why do I like certain songs? And it's really about being moved, right? It's like anything. When you like something because it moves you. It might be it moves you to anger. It might be it moves you to, you know, towards love, perspective, whatever. But music's like that in a lot of ways. But the thing I think about music is you feel it, not just hear it. So you feel it in your, you know, in coming through your ears, but it resonates through your whole body. And so to me, whether that's the lyrics, whether it's the certain passage, you know, whatever that happens to be. And so to me, this one I chose because it's very lyric driven. You know, the song is nice. I've got the acoustic guitars playing, but it's really about, to me, it's the meaning of life. That's really what it's about. It talks about when they say, you know, in that little clip you played, sailing on my ship of safety, till I sank it, I'm crawling on your shores. To me, that's this person reaching out and saying, I need help. I need some help. And then the rest of the song really goes through and says, you know, you don't need education or, you know, religion. People look to working out in the gym. They look at the Bible and religion. They look at all kinds of things. But it really comes down to what is meaningful to you. And only you can find your happiness, find your center, find what moves you. People can help you do that, but you got to do it yourself. So to me, I always comes back. Sometimes, you know, I'll be out in the patio by myself late at night, listening to a little music, and I'll play this song just to kind of inspire me to keep going. You know,
that's awesome.
Keep helping people. Don't tell people what they should do. Help them understand how they can do it. kind of thing. So that's what speaks to me in this song.
Matt, you want to go first? Next?
No, you just got the mic, so you're going to go.
All right. What about this song? What I like about it is just the catchiness of it. It's just a good sounding song. My generation, it wasn't cool to like the Indigo Girls at any time. It was never okay, or at least my way I calculated it. And so I never really, I never spent much time with them, even though I've seen them a couple of times. They've been in a lot of festivals that I've been to, and I would, you know, oh, there they are again. But it's undeniable that that song's good. So while I might have not have ever admitted it out loud, I've always enjoyed that. Because when I saw the list, when we were communicating through email, I was like, is that the Indigo Girls song I know and like? Oh, it is. Good, good, good. That's about as far as I can dig and deep into any Indigo Girls. I don't know the lyrics or anything like that. Plus, I like fine. I like good enough. I like things can just be fine.
Right.
Things can be just okay. It's okay to be fine. So I enjoy that song.
It is a great song.
That is so awesome. And I'm joyous inside because Todd, you bring this perspective that I knew you would bring to this podcast. And Brian, you said something that just hit home. When I lived in Atlanta, I was in a band and we played at this place called Trackside, and it was in Decatur near the railroad tracks. And it was where the Indigo Girls played a lot. And the bar was an LGBTQ bar. And I didn't know that till we started setting up. And I, you know, we're kind of Grateful Dead, country blues, a little bit of Americana rock band. And I'm like, these people are going to hate us, you know, they're, and we started playing and they freaking loved us. and it was magical because it fortified how music breaks down barriers of the way people are. And Todd, you explained it perfectly that, you know, it tells a story and it takes you somewhere. And sometimes I get on my high musician horse and go, well, people that don't play music don't really understand the joy and the feeling you get out of music, the inside feeling. And Todd described that perfectly. You just described what a musician feels on stage when they're playing a song, and you can do that listening to a song. And that just, it blows me away to hear that. And I'm sorry I ever said that about people who aren't musicians, because they feel the same thing that musicians do on stage. Thank you.
Yeah. And this was one of my, you know, I was with you, Brian. I was, you know, growing up, I was much more of the Zeppelin and the Who and, you know, those. By the 80s, I was out of school. You know, I was born in 59, so I'm a little bit older than
I was 10 when that came out.
So by that time, you know, I'd been introduced to a lot more of different varieties, and so I was more open. I don't think I'd have been open if I was 10 or 15 years old. But
well, and also as we'll get closer when we get to mine, I mean, the grunge movement it consumed me. It took over my entire life. It still does. I mean, it's still the foundational time frame of my life of everything that I believe in, almost, and the things that I, you know, the way I, the maturation of my life. And so if it wasn't grunge, if it didn't rock, if it didn't come adjacent at least to the Pacific Northwest, I didn't have time for it. I didn't have any time for it.
Funny you bring that up, because I lived in Seattle. I lived in Queen Anne and Belltown from 94 to 2006. So
that's the time to be there, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's, so we talk about Mudhoney and whatnot, but boy, which by the way, the Mudslide book is a great book, but we'll talk forever about stuff. But
we'll bore
Tony,
people talking
honest,
about Mudhoney, man.
A little shocked when you said these people are going to hate us. That sounds really judgmental. You need to open up yourself.
Well, this was 30 years ago when I was much younger.
I'm sure it's the performance self-doubt too, right? Like, of course they're going to hate me.
Performance anxiety. I got all kinds of things to unpack with you there, but no. This song for me, because this is what? Late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, I think it was 89, 90. Yeah.
So, and this is a whole nother show, and I want to bore people. To me, I was so college rock focused by then. You know, here I am, 19, playing in a band in Jersey, and we're playing a lot at Rutgers and in the whole New Brunswick area, and I'm very much a Church REM guy, and the Indigo Girls came out, and I remember this song well. I remember there. I mean, this, we're leading into grunge now, more or less. Like, yeah, they were kind of this weird. Oh, no, weird's not the word, but they were the bridge. But I also remember them and Melissa Etheridge. Mm-hmm. And I had gone and seen Melissa Etheridge also. Well, like I said, 92-ish. Anyway, different story. But this is a great song. This was right up my alley at the time because I was really, you know, growing up on the Jersey Shore and then going to college, I was really anti-Jovi. No Bon Jovi, no hair metal, no Skid Row. Like, so, you know,
A guy residing in Jersey is an anti-Jovi guy. How does that work out?
No, it was like, this is, you know, again, to me, it was about being cool. And I mean no disrespect to anyone, but you know,
Bon Jovi wasn't cool.
I was a punk rocker, college rocker by then, and man, tight acid wash jeans and long flowing. No, not cool, man. I was already, you know, I was black flagging it and Minor Threat by the, like, I was already been on that diet from like 84 on, but so 14, I mean. And then I was like, they I felt like they had this punk rock sensibility, but they had the melody. Because again, I think someone here, I think you said your sister with the Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah. That's a bridge over troubled waters, in my opinion, might be one of the best songs ever written. Yeah. Again, different topic, but really love this song. Love them. Love the way it's recorded. To this day, I still love the way it sounds.
Yeah, there's a lot of guitar that comes at you in that song, a lot of acoustic guitar, you know, and you don't, you know, if you listen to music mixes back then, it was all rock guitar, loud electric guitars and booming drums and bass. And the Indigo Girls were loud acoustic guitar and booming, you know, with beautiful, loud voices laid over the top of them. It just,
And they've got recorder in that music too. Someone's playing a recorder. I mean, that's the one of the things that I thought of was, you know, this is transitioning from when we were kids. There was no MTV, right? I mean, maybe you just when you were, but there was no MTV till I was in college. And so music you heard in your head and you've got a vision of what that song was, what it meant and whatever. And then the MTV came along and now you showed you could see the video, and some of that helped, some of it didn't, but you know,
remember,
make a difference to me.
Yeah, this was the time where, you know, think of who's out there that time, female-wise. It's you got Annie Lennox, you've got Melissa Etheridge, you've got Sarah McLachlan.
Sinead
O'Connor, so, and for me, my favorite album of that year was The Replacements. Again, not a female, but was The Replacements' Don't Tell a Soul album. Like that, I mean, I'm head down. So again, this fit right in the wheelhouse for me. And it was, I really, really enjoyed the fact that women were playing. I mean, I was playing with a woman on the side too. And I love the fact that women play. So, and this holds up. It's genderless to me. Just happens. I mean, between it's every bit as good as I said as a Simon and Garfunkel. If you want to compare duos, it's good for them.
Fair. Yeah, it's a good point on the women too. You know, because I mean, Fleetwood Mac was getting popular then, and that was a lot driven by, you know, Stevie Nicks and Lindsey McVay and others, and you know, kind of transitioned from, you know, Grace Slick was one of those ones that we all listened to, I'm sure, Jefferson Airplane, but she was one of the few female fronts.
We were just a few years away at that time, a little bit past the release of that Indigo Girls song, from Lilith Fair, The traveling festival that Sarah McLachlan's, I think she was the overall head of that. And so not long after that, that movement of women's folk and rock, but certainly folk music really, really took off.
Very true.
Festivals were becoming a thing.
Yeah. You know what, Todd, that Jazz Fest we went to with you guys, I was going to go off by myself and listen to Herbie Hancock, who was playing in one of the tents that in the front as you walk in. And the tent before Herbie Hancock was Melissa Etheridge. And I just kind of poked my head in there, you know, this, what's going on in here? And I'm here to tell you, I never made it to Herbie Hancock because Melissa Etheridge just fucking blew the room away. And I went in there. And I started texting Todd and Jan and them. I'm like, yeah, you guys gotta come over here and listen to this. And she just, Matt, you and I talk about musicians who get up on stage and they don't give a fuck. You know, she didn't care. She's got up there and like blew it away. Just
so I saw
she came to Chattanooga a couple of months later and we went and saw her in Chattanooga. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I cut you off. I didn't, but yeah, I hate that, you know. It's good that we lump them in or not. I don't know. But yeah, you can't have a conversation around this time, especially with female musicians and rock artists without Melissa Etheridge. That band was phenomenal. I saw her in New York, went with the drummer of my band at the time, because that's how we really, he's like, dude, I got to see this drummer. I'm hearing nothing about how good her drummer is. And I have to be honest, here I am, early 20s. Yeah, we walked into that room. And I had never in my life seen so many women with women. But it was the first time I was in a room where I was really true minority. And I got to be honest, when I was younger, especially, I was playing guitar to meet women. And that was not the place I was going to do it.
No, it wasn't.
I had to stay in my lane. And they made... enjoy the music, but stay in your lane, you rock boy.
That's great choice, Todd. You sparked a really good conversation from that one. All right, let's go to Brian's. This is Pearl Jam Alive. I listen to the Pearl Jam channel on Sirius all the time. It's a great choice, Brian. Thank you for choosing this one. Play a little bit of it here.
Oh, I got a lot to say about this.
Well, I'll be brief. The reason I asked in an email to look at that specific part is first of all, it's just the best live version professionally recorded you'll find in Italy from 2006. And what I love about that song is, well, first of all, it is my favorite song of all time. Like, what's your favorite song? It's Alive. I think you guys understand, like, variations of favorite songs. Like, do I really want to hear it right now? Not really, but it's of importance. It's my favorite. And so, especially that part right there. Sorry, Matt, one second. And so the main reason I love that song so much is the transformational aspect of it. That song was written about the I'm alive was like an apology. I'm still alive. It wasn't a celebration. It was like, everything sucks. My family, my loved ones, my dad, all these things. It's one of the very first songs Pearl Jam as a band put together, like in an hour in 1991 out of nowhere. And then over the course of 25 years, it turned into, basically because of the way the audience received it for all those years, as this ultimate celebration of being alive. And right there at that moment where he's singing, right before they go into that solo, right before that cutoff, he changes the lyrics to, you and me, look at all of us, we're all still alive. 20 years ago, it was a darker, and I guess I'm still alive, whatever, you know. And it's the transformational aspect of that song. I feel every second of every minute. Cause I, of course, as a kid, oh, everything's horrible. And then you turn an adult and you're like, it's not that bad. It's just a perfect arc of a transformation of a song for me.
Awesome.
Yeah, I just wanted to define your favorite. So it's just for whenever I say favorite, this is my thing. If I'm on my deathbed, what's the last song I want to listen to? It's the last movie I want to watch. If I got, I'm going.
That's a good, those are good qualifiers.
Yeah, yeah, like that's what your favorite is.
That's good qualifiers. And this is a when I'm in a casket, I, you know, play alive at some point today. You know, for real. So yeah, that falls into that category. Let me not bury the total lead here. The song's awesome. So there's that too.
Yeah, it's an awesome song. Then we heard that riff in the video, the original video. If you remember, that's what made it great too, because you got to watch Pearl Jam again. This is anti Bon Jovi.
Just a live concert.
Very true.
You're in the Moore Theater in Seattle, and he's climbing up and he drops himself in the audience. He's up on the rafters, and you're like, and I've been to the Moore Theater for many shows, that show, but man, I heard that. I saw that. Watched the movie Singles.
Yeah,
and that's how I ended up from Jersey into Seattle. I was like, I'm in the wrong place.
I was just at the Singles apartment building 2.5 weeks ago, Matt.
Love
I was
it.
Just there getting pictures in front of the damn apartment building. I'm sure the 20-somethings are like, oh, God, here's some more Gen Xers taking pictures at our because that stupid asshole movie from 35 years ago.
Great movie, like I said, between the song a lot, and it wasn't Nirvana, believe it or not. I was not really a big Nirvana. Was fine. I'm not here to just, but Alive, man, when that hit.
One more thought, I'll go, and Todd, you can jump in, and Tony too. I've same way. Nirvana, great, and I understand they are really the catalyst for the entire grunge movement.
No, Mudhoney is.
Well, Green River. Again, we want to do a whole podcast on that.
That's a whole different topic.
Excellent. And Green River and Malfunction and Mother Love, we can do that all day. But from a national level, they're the ones that really, that's where it started. But they were always just, they're pretty good. I like Nirvana. Their music's good. But that's about as far as it went.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually don't have a whole lot to add because the grunge was just something I never really got into. I think I was in graduate school at the time. Met my wife. I was more.
Oh, it wasn't designed for you. It wasn't designed for you. You got to be
exactly.
You got to be a late teen and angry as hell and hate everything.
Exactly. Yeah, well,
things are good. The future's so bright. You got to wear shades.
Yeah, I was an angry late 20 something, but.
At the time I was listening to Violent Femmes and others. So, you know, it wasn't all, you know, roses and everything.
Yeah, there's some angst there too. It's just, it's packaged differently. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely.
This is a great song choice, great band choice. I think when it's all said and done, and I hate to think back on things that are current, Eddie Vedder will be, and should be considered as great as Dylan, as great as any other great songwriter. And for me, what makes Pearl Jam such a fantastic band is the songwriting. You know, I'm a guitarist first and foremost, the purist. The guy on my pinnacle of guitar playing is Joe Satriani, who's not just a great guitar player, but he's a great songwriter. He writes good chord progression. He writes good melody. And if you think about Pearl Jam, they exemplify that beautifully. So you're not going to find the greatest guitar players in rhythm section in all of rock and roll. You're going to find people that are fantastic. McCready's certainly one of the better guitar players around. But what makes them so wonderful is the great songwriting Eddie Vedder and the rest of the band do, and how they bring it together and The individual parts make the whole more than the individual parts. And this song is a great example of that. And I just, I love Pearl Jam. I listen to the Pearl Jam radio, and a lot of times I'll hear something I've never heard before that Pearl Jam did. And I'll go, man, this is something else they did that was amazingly good. But, you know, if you're a guitar player, if any musicians are listening to this, if you're a guitar player and you're spending your time learning how to shred, shredders are a dime a dozen. Spend your time learning how to write music. Writing music is going to make people notice you and sell more of your product than any amount of shredding you can do. Songwriting is the way to go, and Pearl Jam is a good example.
Well, one point to that, Tony, is that as a young aspiring guitar player in the early 90s, Pearl Jam's not good. It's not like the Communication Breakdown, Matt. It's not like Smoke on the Water. They don't have a lot of riffs that are like simple to learn. They're not that complicated, but it's the layering of all their music from the riffs to the bass to the McCrae. Right. It's all, like you said, the sum of the parts, and then Eddie's poetry on top of that. So it's like, hey, I want to learn this song. I'm like, well, that's easier said than done. Now, you want to learn a bunch of Nirvana, 4-chord progressions, you're going to do that by the end of the day. And that's, it serves its purpose too. So yeah, it's a great place to learn, but it's a frustrating place to learn. Because you won't have Smoke on the Water to impress your friends by the end of the day. You'll have a song that's not really a song without the other parts often, right. which can make that a little difficult. But yeah,
so your point. I think you'll find that on some levels, this is really, I got so many places I can go with this, and this is, we could do a whole podcast on, you know, what Steve Turner said, his thoughts on MacReady and how Pearl Jam came together.
Steve Turner from Mudhoney, correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Correct. And Gosser and that whole scene. It's really fascinating. But so you got this new generation of guitar players that, you know, especially me as an older guy, they do play the riffs, and this is one of the riffs they play, and they love Black as another off this album, off 10. They are great. And I MacReady and Gossard, Tony, to your point about the guitar players, man, I actually love Stone Gossard, and you'll find it as we talk with most music, it's usually the more rhythm guy that I like I'll rather go on a Malcolm Young kick or a Scott Ian kick if we're getting into bands, and Ronnie Wood. And I love my lead players, but man, I love those guys who can hold down a rhythm. And that's, you know, Jeff Ament and Stone Gossard really hold those songs down. And if I'm not mistaken, they're the actual writers, I believe. Eddie comes with the lyric, but the music is basically Ament and Gossard's jamming. MacReady then plays over it, and I think the Pearl Jam now is on like their sixth or seventh drummer.
They've got the drummers. They got the Spinal Tap thing going with the drummers, but Gossard was a primary songwriter of all the early stuff with him and Ament, as they worked together for 10 years before they were, you know, in other bands. Since in the later years, there's a distribution of songwriting that's a little different, but the amount, the way that they've been able to, for all these years, just abandon all traditional ways of distributing music, and still have the trust of fans and fill up arenas and play these random ass songs that most people have never heard of, and they can still do it over and over again, is also just another mind blowing. It doesn't even matter whether we agree that it's good or not. It's insane that they can still do this all the way, you know, till four months ago.
Could you make the argument, and I think you can, that they are the last great rock band? We don't actually have, and I'm talking about worldwide, again, another subject altogether, but just think about this for anyone that's listening. Worldwide, sellout shows worldwide, and like people are buying the posters, wearing the shirts
for multiple decades.
Yeah, yeah. Like who after them? I don't know. Maybe
who's going to carry the torch? Yeah.
Who is it? Because I used to make it. It was Metallica, but then Metallica came along.
I was about to say.
Yeah.
Metallica comes to mind quickly. I'm not a huge fan, but I get what they do. Metallica comes to mind there. I'm sure we could come up with a couple more.
Oasis, maybe.
But if they didn't quit for so many years.
Right, but they're not. No one's buying an Oasis shirt. No one, I don't think, is truly hanging up an Oasis poster, but they are with Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. The last real great, I don't know.
With that kind of longevity and that kind of catalog, I mean, they're my favorite band, Matt, so I ain't going to disagree with any of this stuff.
Yeah. It's the material, you know. I went and saw the Big Star Quintet a couple of months ago in the Basement East in Nashville.
What a great venue.
It's got Mike Mills from REM and the original Big Star drummer, Jody, I forget Jody's last name. And then a guy from the DBs was playing every instrument. And then the front man was the guy from the Posies. And midway through the concert, somebody from the crowd screamed, "You guys sound great." And like that, Mike Mills said, "It's the material, you know," and it is the material. You know, you can have four Jesuses on stage playing all the musical instruments, but if he doesn't have good songs that he has written, or they have written, or she has written, then it's just a bunch of guys on stage making noise. So this is the thing I love about Pearl Jam. You know, not one musician in that band is going to fit on my Mount Rushmore of musicians, but collectively they play the songs that they write beautifully, and the songs that they write are the material.
Jesuses. Man, what did you do before?
I wasn't sure that there was one. There's four.
Four of them.
All right, let's go to my turn. I've got to pull it up here.
Talk about four Jesuses. Let's go to Tony's turn.
So Santana, one of the reasons I ever started playing guitar in the late 1970s was Carlos Santana. My family is Hispanic, Latino, more Mexican than Spanish. My mother's family grew up around Guadalajara, and they came to Utah sometime in the 1920s or 30s for the copper mines. And I come from a family of seven, and I was the only one in my family that ever picked up a guitar. And one day I was sitting there playing my guitar, and my mother grabs it and says, "Son, here, let me show you what we used to do." And I never knew she was musically inclined at all. And she, with her long fingernails, she picked up my guitar and started chording. And I was like, "Oh my God." And she's like, she said something to the effect, "I'm so proud of you. You were the last of my children. You were the only one that learned how to play music. We used to sit around our entertainment when I was a kid, is we'd sit around on the porch, and all my uncles and brothers and sisters would pull out their guitars and they would play guitar." You know, this would be the 1930s, probably not too far from the Depression, you know, where you didn't have anything, but you had family, and apparently they had guitars. So Santana, I gravitated towards Santana for the rhythmic beats. And if you ask Santana about these beats, he won't say they're Hispanic, he'll say they're African. And so it was no wonder that I gravitated towards that, because at the time I was listening to a lot of Motown. I'm a huge Motown fan. And you know, I've probably seen Santana as much as I've seen the Grateful Dead. So he's one of my favorites. And when I saw them in concert playing this song, you know, it just blew me away. Not just for his guitar playing, because he's obviously a phenomenal guitar player, but the beats, the rhythms, the conga, the bass just went right into my insides. And yeah, so this song holds a special place into me from family memories, but also from the first time I saw him in concert at the Mobile Municipal Auditorium in the late 1970s. Just incredible. All around, every corner of the sound spectrum, from drums to bass to guitars to organ, was just fantastic. And it is from Santana that my love of Journey comes, because half of the band in Santana went on to play in Journey. On stage with Carlos Santana at Woodstock. On stage was a 15-year-old Neil Sean, who's the guitar player in Journey. And my Mount Rushmore of guitar players has Neil Sean on it, right next to Jimi Hendrix. So that's my song.
Nice. Well, I love this album. I mean, of all the I love Santana. I would say that if a casual Santana fan would probably not think of Moonflower as being one of their favorite albums.
It's my favorite as well.
Yeah, I mean, because it's so, to me, I call it atmospheric. When you showed that clip and you show the picture on top, to me, I close my eyes and I feel like I'm a bird flying above those clouds. It's just so free and easy and movement and, you know, relaxing. That's, to me, that's one of the things that moves me too. And that's one, that whole album does.
Good to hear.
Yeah, it's Santana, like for me again, I'm diving into guitar now. I'm 13, 14 years old, 83, 84. So my true introduction to Santana, to your point, was the video to Black Magic Woman, which, yes, even at that age, I noticed, hey, that's Neil Sean in the band. You know, we didn't have the internet, and I'm like, he's in that video. But anyway, my buddy across the street from where I lived had an album collection, or his father had an album collection, and obviously part of that was Abraxas, and we would listen to that. And
fantastic album.
Yeah, but what I really like for me as I evolve, and I love Carlos Santana, probably Blues for El Salvador is my favorite album of his, but I'm a big, when you talk about Mount Rushmore guitar players, I'm going to have to think about that. For consideration for me would be Peter Green. Like, I love the original Fleetwood Mac. And if you listen to Peter Green and you listen to Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, especially this song, you can hear the influence of Peter Green. And he won't shy from that. You know,
yeah.
He is Peter Green is one of my, if not my favorite blues player. And it's a reason why I love Santana, because it's just that whole feel. He has a whole spiritual side to it. Yeah, and yeah. Just
so for those of you that may not know, Fleetwood Mac did Black Magic Woman originally, and Peter Green was the writer of that song, and Santana covered it. So
yeah, it's a cover.
I'm going to school on Santana here. I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah, man, if you want to be introduced to Santana and have your mind blown, listen to the Abraxas album. There are a couple of cuts off of Abraxas that'll grab you like Good Times, Bad Times does.
Well, yeah. I went through a stretch of what we'll call classic rock fandom in the late 90s, after the grunge scene started to die off a little bit, and I started to get into more Southern rock, Allman Brothers, which I know we'll get to here in a minute, Lynyrd Skynyrd. And all the staples of classic rock. But I think Santana was a little too sophisticated for me at that age. I wanted things I could understand a little bit better, possibly. And Led Zeppelin was easy to understand. Allman Brothers were very easy for me to understand. I think Santana was difficult for me. A lot of instrumentals. So then I'm like, what are we really doing here? The few songs I do know, they're fine. And then Rob Thomas comes in and the biggest song in the world, Smooth, which at the time I thought was ridiculous. Now I think is one of the better songs of the 90s. So it's like, but I, all that to say, I don't know a whole lot about the guy and the lineage of it all, but I have seen Santana a couple of times. Yeah. And enjoy it. What?
Yeah. Also listen to his work with the later albums with John Lee Hooker too.
Oh yeah.
See, yeah. I haven't heard those like either. I said, we, anything we talk about here, I can take you down a rabbit hole probably. Unless so in the country, I've been, I can't take you down that rabbit hole. I don't think.
So one of the other songs on that album that you, Moonflower, is She's Not There. That's a cover. Yeah. It's not Santana. Mm-hmm. Didn't write that one either. But to me, that's one of the going into a guitar solo and he says, you know, it's too late to say I'm sorry. I don't know. Why should I care? Don't bother trying to look for her. She's not there. And then he goes into one of these wailing guitar solos. One of my favorites.
Dude, you're giving me chills. I know exact. I saw him do that live. And
man,
what a great call out. Because like when I very first saw him, I don't know what year it was again, all this late 90s or early 90s, late 80s. And they did She's Not There. Yeah. And he hits that. And it's like, yeah, right on. Great. Yeah,
absolutely.
You're exactly right.
That's a good call. And he talks. You hear him talking and you feel the feelings out of his fingers when he's playing that instrument. And that's a special thing about Santana. I remember seeing Santana at Music Midtown a long time ago. If you know of Music Midtown, I think it turned into the Shaky Knees Festival or something like that.
I love the old Music Midtown Festival.
Was amazing. So I saw him in the old Music Midtown, and every act had to be off stage by 10 o'clock because Music Midtown is downtown in a residential kind of area. And about 10:15, that they were trying to get him to get off stage, and he says to the crowd, he says, they're trying to tell me to stop playing. What do you guys want me to do? And everybody just went fucking nuts. And he played for another hour. He didn't stop playing until about 11:15. And, you know, another instance of a musician getting up there and, you know, just they don't give a fuck. They're just going to play. And here's what I got. And, you know, he's truly a musician's musician, but he's also truly a music fan, non-musician's musician. Let's move on to the next tune. It's a Matt tune. That he selected, Ozzy Osbourne's I Don't Know. Okay, great song. Great selection, Matt.
Yeah, I'm giving you the wrong impression of me. but there's a method to my madness. I'm just sticking with 10-year-old me here. I'm sticking to my journey in music and like how I realize this is something that, again, that I just love. I knew I loved music. Like I loved guitar and I wanted to play guitar. So again, like the Led Zeppelin, I now have the Cars First cassette. I now have Led Zeppelin 1. I think I picked up a few others along the way. I think I might have the Kinks 1 for the road by now and pick up the Cars Panorama. But and my cousins gave me cassette to Black Sabbath, Paranoid, and Jimi Hendrix. Are You Experienced? All great, all cool, but not not moving the needle like the first time hearing the Zeppelin song. So I go to the store with my money. I get Ozzy Osbourne because apparently that's brand new again. I'm 10 years old here. It's 1980. The new album's out. And that cover scared the shit out of me. What am I about to listen to? Again, like the Led Zeppelin, I go home. I take the cellophane off. I pop open the cover. I put it in. I don't know what I'm about to hear. Slip it down, hit play. Opened up just like you had played it. And I was just like, what's going on? Simply got to the guitar solo and it was just wailing away. And as I said, again, oh my God, this is awesome. Now, I don't know anything about music. I don't know who's in the bands. I'm 10. I just know I like it. I actually thought Ozzy was the guitar player. I thought Ozzy was the guitar player at 10. And I was just, anyway, Mount Rushmore guitars that you like to bring up when it comes to that style of guitar. Randy Rhoads. I was a Randy Rhoads over Eddie Van Halen guy. I don't shoot me, don't send me emails. That's fine. But definitely, I'm more on Team Randy.
Same here. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, with Ozzy, I'm Team Zakk Wylde. But that's going to be.
So he grew up in my town, and we took classical guitar lessons from the same teacher.
Oh wow!
He studied before me. Anyway,
well, that's just the timing and the generational aspect of it. It was the No More Tears album that got me into to Ozzy, and then the Osmosis and all that kind of stuff. So all I knew was Zakk Wylde at first, and then I hear about this other guitar player. I'm like, oh well, he's not as good as Zach. Zach's the guy, you know. So that I'm talking about when I first, you know, discovered it. Never got too far into Ozzy, never got too far into Black Sabbath, enjoyed them both, but that's about as far as it goes for me. I liked it, didn't love it, and it's always been that way with me with Ozzy. I like it, don't love it. And then that dumb MTV show, I'm telling you guys, that ruined me a little bit with Ozzy. I couldn't stand that damn show, and I didn't like the over-acting performance of Ozzy. I'm like, Ozzy, you're not this dumb. Stop acting dumb. I know you're not dumb. Don't be dumb. But Sharon had that whole thing mapped out for everybody. Yeah. She had it all together, and it worked. It was a smash, so who cares what I think?
Right.
Yeah, I definitely was a Sabbath fan growing up, but I'm a little bit like you, Brian. There's not real one song that stands out to me. You know, I put on the album, I play it, I really enjoyed it, but it's not one that I go back to and say, let me play some Black Sabbath while I'm out on my patio this weekend, you know, and that kind of stuff. Whereas I'll go back to some of the other stuff that I listened to back at 10 years old or 15 years old. I didn't know Ozzy wasn't the guitar player either when I first, you know, started listening to him. I couldn't tell you the names of the other players, you know, like a lot of bands, I could tell you who was in the band because you'd read those cliff notes and you read those album covers and everything. To me, that Sabbath was all about their artwork. Like you said, it scared the shit out of you, but they had some crazy artwork. And that's really what I remember is their album covers and whatnot.
One more thought on that real quick. We were just talking about this after Ozzy passed on one of the pods that I do is that the idea that it was real devilish and, you know, satanic and scary. It was because it kind of looked that way, but really it's some of the most practical music ever written. I mean, War Pigs is still like, it's just the lyrics of it stand up to this moment in time that we live in right now. It's like, this isn't scary. Well, it's scary because it's true.
But it's real.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like this orchestrated, let's make a scary movie out of music.
Right.
I find it to be very practical music and very excellent with lyrics that really speak to the day in, day out chaos of the world.
Well, what I think is funny is what you said is, so back then, in the 80s, again, I'm going 80s, early 80s, and I remember as we got into the mid-80s and the PMRC, like this stuff was just so anti-establishment and just And I remember it was recently, I guess, and by recently in the past, probably, 20 years, I was in Dick's Sporting Good, and I remember hearing Crazy Train on coming over the sound system. And I was thinking to myself, if times, how they have changed.
Yeah.
Like this is now, Ozzy's now music to shop by.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to the demographic.
It's mall music now.
Yeah. And what strikes me about Ozzy is the outrageousness of it, is his persona, his album covers. But when I first discovered Randy Rhoads, I was listening to a lot of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Johnson, and I just discovered Joe Satriani, and I hear this Randy Rhoads. This is probably after Randy Rhoads died, so that'll kind of tell you what I was listening to. And it wasn't Ozzy Osbourne; it was probably more a Black Flag and Winnebago Warrior. But I picked up my guitar one day, and I had just heard Crazy Train, and I was like, oh, listen, I can play that. It's not very hard to play. And then I was like, oh shit, I can play this hard rock stuff. But Randy Rhoads for me was just he punched you in the face with his guitar, you know, and then he just held on to you after he punched you. And Ozzy's vocals are kind of like that, you know. His vocals are big and they come out big, and they're, you know, if you're a sound man, and I'm a sound man lately, you don't have any problem mixing vocals for Ozzy Osbourne. You know, he's you don't have to say, hey, can you sing into the mic, or can you be louder? Can you, you know, he's just there. And I think that's the thing that I really like about Black Sabbath and Ozzy's solo stuff, is that as big as the guitar is, his vocals are just as big, and his lyrics or his songwriting is really good, and it stands the test of time, you know. So they have to be up there as one of the greats.
Yeah, I'm painting myself as some kind of like metal guy, and I got to tell you, I'm not. I'm just giving you everyone a starting point here.
Well, to that point, Matt, I was a little bit disappointed when you scratched the Feeling Gravity's Pull from REM as one of your songs speak to you're not necessarily a metal guy, because there ain't nothing metal about that. And I could talk about REM for forever. So
honestly, that is little. So now that would be second generation stuff, because this, again, another podcast for you.
Yeah.
There, but that's, this is going to tell you, this is how the transition happened. That's like, if we do this, we get this again, the next two songs, we're going to go into the next transition of not just listening to music and what I found I really like, but also, I like this guitar playing better.
It's damn near an impossible task to pick just two songs.
Yeah.
Right.
Pick two. What two? What are you talking
two?
About?
Why? Sorry. I gotta be able to keep it together. I need theme. What?
But one of the other things.
We're going to do this again with more songs. I can see this already. This is good.
So one of the things, driving it back to Ozzy and Black Sabbath, to me, Ozzy was one of those early guys that was really about show, right? I mean, you think about Zeppelin and you think about The Who. They were musicians. They went up there, of course,
rock.
Daltrey swinging his mic and everything. But Ozzy was one of those, like Alice Cooper, right? Alice Cooper came on to shock people. And to me, that's kind of, Ozzy was one of those people that was more than the music. It was trying to shock people.
He was embracing the new media. You know, that was about the time you first started seeing music videos, and he was a guy that had his pulse on what was going on in media and exploited that.
Yep. That's funny that you brought up Alice Cooper, because if there was three songs and I was staying in category about the same time, I would give you the Killers album. So.
I saw Alice Cooper when I was about 12 or 13, and he descended from on high in this net, down this net that looked like a spider web, and he just kind of crawled down it and came on the stage and started singing. It was crazy. All right, let's go to the next song. It's going to be Todd's choice, Blue Sky from the Allman Brothers. Mm.
Yeah, why did I pick this song? That to me, this works on many levels. They start off right at the beginning. This is kind of going back to my comment about the Moonflower and Santana. To me, when I just hear that intro, before you ever hear a lyric, right, just close your eyes and you can imagine a river. You can imagine just flowing along, right? And then right off the bat, they come up with Walk Along the River, Sweet Lullaby. They just keep on flowing. Don't worry about where it's going. To me, it just says, you know, the river is living life. You know, it is going. Don't try and steer it. Just take what it comes. So to me, that first beginning just sets the whole mood for the song. But in the end, it really transitions to it's a love song. I mean, it's a traditional, it's a very traditional Dickie Betts song, right? And it's the song's written, love letter to his girlfriend, but he changes it. So he's talking about she's the blue sky. She's not the girl. She's the blue sky, which means it's broader than that, right? I mean, it's her, it's his world, my blue sky. And so to me, it's also a love song in that sense. And then just the line, you know, you make me high when you turn your love my way. I mean, how does it get better than that? I mean, how do you describe the intense feeling you feel with somebody that you love, right? You make me high. I mean, that's what you want. And so to me, that's why I chose the song. Just, I mean, there's so many levels that I like it. Before I forget, Tony, you mentioned Jazz Fest and seeing Melissa Etheridge. I think I was in the tent watching the Allman Brothers at that point. Because, I mean, this was late Allman Brothers. You know, several of the original members had died, but Derek Trucks was there playing. And Dickie. And so, yeah, at that point. So, yeah. And to me, Eat a Peach is is the consummate driving song. If I'm on the road and I want to play something, it just that background just, you know, makes you feel like you're just moving down the road.
Very true. Great, great choice, Todd. Go ahead, Brian, Matt.
No, I agree. Oh, yeah, I agree. We've got the, you know, we talked about Abraxas earlier, Eat a Peach. We brought up, you know, other albums that are alive, 10. These are, not only are we picking great songs here, these are great albums that, and I love Dickie Betts. I love this song. It might actually be my favorite Allman Brothers song. I kind of like the more laid back. I do love the Dead. I'm really not much of a jam band person, so I don't like when things get out too far. And this is them playing an actual song. This was a great, great hit for them. And it was a great, you know, like Ramblin' Man. These were really, honestly, great radio songs for the time, too. And still are. Anyway, yeah. It's my thought of the song. It's a great pick, and it actually goes along with your Indigo Girl song, I think. They're really nice together.
Thanks.
Yeah, I could talk about the Allman Brothers for a while. I'll keep it as brief as possible. Probably my favorite Allman Brothers song, probably. And I'll expand on that when we get to my last song as to one of the reasons why. But also, I was a Dickie Betts guy as much as I could be at the young age that I was. And then he was out of the band shortly after. So I was that I got into him in the 90s, and I was like as heartbroken as you can be as a kid who doesn't spend a lot of time on being heartbroken. And but what I love about the band is that they've been able, like Greg Allman in my era is the least important member most of the time. I mean, the people that come and go, Warren Haynes, I'm a big Warren Haynes guy. And so there's just so much about the Allman Brothers that I love. And like Ramblin' Man, that's all the Dickie Betts songs. I just think he's the best songwriter of the band. Ramblin' Man, Highway 41, rolling down Highway 41. I mean, I spent my life trying to find a Highway 41 sign because it was like my Route 66. You know, like it's the pathway to the north and south before the interstate system kind of thing. Like all these little things come together in my mind when it comes to the Allman Brothers. They exemplify the South in a way that was better, I thought, more eloquent than Skinner did. Skinner was a little more, we're smoking, drinking, being idiots, you know, and having fun. I like that stuff too, but I thought the Allman Brothers did it better. And then that was my gateway into more Dead and jam band era of my life into the early 2000s. I love that song, Blue Sky. And one last thought of albums, to your point, Matt, that these are all good albums. I don't know all of the ones we're talking about, but Eat a Peach, Harvest, Neil Young's Harvest, Grateful, yes. Dead, Grateful Dead's American Beauty. Those were all about, I believe they might have all been 1972, but they were between 70-ish and 74, all three of those albums. I don't know if you can find three more important albums in the last 50 years. You know, I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can. But those all
stick, great call out.
Those all stick out to me. And just, and speaking of artwork, and I mean, I have my dad's old vinyl collection, so I have Eat a Peach in mint condition. And just, I mean, it's a work of art in itself with all the mush. I mean, I love the Allman Brothers and that song.
Good call, Todd. And that song is another one of those, not too unlike Good Times, Bad Times. You know, it at the very beginning of the song, it just reaches out and grabs you with that beautiful melodic guitar at the beginning. And he doesn't waste time coming in with the vocals because he wants to talk about this beautiful girl and how she makes him feel. You know, she wraps her essence around him as if it was the blue sky underneath on top of you. So great choice. You can't say enough about the Allman Brothers. They were,
yeah. And the other, this song is, as Matt said, it's kind of radio because I didn't notice, but it's, I think it's less than 4 minutes. It's probably three minutes. You know, some of the Allman Brothers, you know, the Whipping Post and some of those go on forever. Great songs.
But Dreams and stuff like that. Yeah.
Good call. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is one Brian chose, Low by Cracker. Man, I got so much to say about this song. But go ahead,
yeah, Brian. Great song.
Yeah, I'll set it up quickly, and I'm very interested to what you guys will say because it's a little bit of a niche pick. And Matt, I have a feeling we could talk music a lot. I mean, we all can, but I can tell there's a lot of wavelength similarity there. The main reason I picked that one for today's discussion is because I have this. Maybe a lot of people do this. I don't know, but. And Blue Sky is another one because that was one of the first Allman Brothers songs I remember like knowing. I'm sure I'd heard Ramblin' Man before that or something like that, but that's my first vivid memory of, oh, this is Allman Brothers. Same thing, Pearl Jam Alive. This is Pearl Jam. Same thing with Cracker and Low. This is Cracker. And so the first songs I know are my favorite songs. That doesn't mean they're the best songs necessarily. That could be their best song. They still play Cracker, David Lowery, Johnny Hickman, and all the variations of stuff they do. I've seen them countless times. And I think there was it was unconscious for me at first. When I reverse engineer this to try to figure out why some of these bands are my favorite, is that Pearl Jam was my favorite from the jump. And they're just international stars. These are not people you're going to get close to. These are not people you're going to interview. These are not people you're going to have any, unless you have just the luckiest situation in your life. Over time, I started to get into bands like Driving and Crying and Cracker and why can't I think of a better example quickly right now? But there's a handful. Cake, maybe. Southern Culture on the Skids. Some of that kind of stuff. Bands that I tended to start to love and that I could also meet. And that to a certain level, I could get to know almost. That brought a whole nother dynamic to it. Top five bands, Crackers third, right? Like, of all the amazing legendary bands I love and know, they're one of my, they're top, partially because I don't know them, but that relationship over 30 years has meant a lot. And so the fact you even were excited that we're playing a song at all, Matt, was kind of made me smile for certain. If it wasn't on my face, it was inside. So just such a great band, folk Americana rock that you won't find anywhere else, from Camper Van Beethoven, the Precursor, the whole Athens connection there. They're not from Athens, but there's a lot of Athens connections. So there's, it's very layered, but I'd be interested to hear what you guys have to say.
Well, I have a running debate going on with a friend of mine right now of bands that had great first and second albums. And he was unimpressed with this pick, but one, I'm a big David Lowery fan, big Johnny Hickman fan. Follow him. I'm with you, Cracker. I can't say enough. That is music I love. And anyway, I think this is their second album. I think their first two albums have the best, one of the best 1-2 punches in rock folklore history, as far as I'm concerned. And
that was it after the two. I mean, they have 8 albums, 9 albums since, but those two, and the most interesting dynamic of it is that it fell right in the middle of grunge. Lowry's got a new song talking about how my songs were not supposed to work and they did. It's like, this is Americana. This is not grunge. This is not angry. This is not even, we're not angry at all. And it somehow worked for just a minute and then it didn't, but he was able to piggyback that to an entire career of making music, which I find just as fascinating as the people who are Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. If you can still do this your whole life, that, wow, you know?
Yeah. I love him because, again, they weren't new to me. I was a Camper Van Beethoven fan.
Yeah.
I was, you know, pictures of Max Stitch.
Yeah.
So are they
the Skins with Bowling? Love that.
So I'm a fan of Camper Van Beethoven. Did they come out of that? Were there some common members in Cracker? Because I'm not familiar.
Yeah, just David Lowery is basically, he is the brainchild of both those bands.
Okay.
Then he's got, you know, there's a lot of members coming and going, primary songwriters that he worked with in both bands. Okay. But it is him and him, really, is what made all that happen. And I'd say if you're into REM in the mid 80s and weird college rock, then you were into Camper Van Beethoven too.
Bowling for Columbine and some of those.
They were just in Athens last week. It was last Wednesday. I really wanted to go, but I just couldn't go over there.
They still tour a lot. I mean, Dave's in his mid 60s now. I don't know how long he'll keep doing this, but he's also an adjunct professor at UGA in music theory.
Yeah, I knew that too. Yeah.
The guy is the smartest guy in the room, and he'll let you know it.
Yeah,
he'll let you know it.
Yeah. I remember him being around town when I was there. I moved to Athens in '87. So, but this song, there's so much about this song I love. I couldn't tell you, other than the Camper Van Beethoven connection and Lowry, I couldn't tell you another member of Cracker. I couldn't tell you probably more than 2 or 3 songs other than Low. But this song is another song, not unlike Good Times, Bad Times, where the beginning of the song, they're just boom, you're here. And I'm here to take you on this journey. But then it has this thing that all great bands do. Matt, you and I were talking about this the other day with the Retrophonics with Jim and Gio. And it has this thing where they come down in a low dynamic and they slide this acoustic guitar in there. And it's when I think about how I engineer music, and I'm engineering a lot more music now with Rooftop, and I have been for years, but more focused now. The beauty of sound mixing is finding spaces and bringing all those spaces out across the music spectrum. And this recording is, it does that perfectly. If you were to listen to something that I master or mix, you'd hear a lot of bass and a lot of guitar, and I'd try to slice some acoustic guitar in there. But for me, my mixes, and one of the reasons I love this song is that the bass and the drums are just there, you know. And I envisioned the first time that the engineer shared this with them, they're like, ooh, that's a lot of bass and drums. And the band was probably going, fuck yeah, it is. I love it. And I do that when I mix stuff down, and I've done a couple of bands now in the studio, and I send them to them, and you hear a lot of bass and drums, and I'm always worried, you know, are they going to come back and they say, oh, that's too much. And the first guys that I did a couple months ago was Zantetti. I don't know if you know Zantetti, a local band. They're rock and roll, but the first comment was, oh, I love how you mix drums. And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about this song.
Yeah, I used to play with those guys, as a matter of fact.
You did?
That's how you got on my radar, I'm guessing. But one thought real quick to what you're talking about as far as the music, what's so fascinating about that song itself is the simplistic nature of it, except it doesn't sound simplistic. It sounds very layered and intricate, and it's not. It's the same four chord progression the entire song. It's D, C, E minor, G. It's boom, the whole song, but it doesn't sound like it's the same thing the whole song.
Yeah, it is. And I would flip that. And from a musician standpoint, and I know you're a musician too, I would flip that and say it's one of those songs that sounds easy, but when you start trying to play it and start trying to replicate the layers and the dynamic of up and down that it does, it's really hard. There are a couple of songs Matt and I do in the Retrophonics that sound really simple. One of them is Pictures of You. It sounds really simple if you were to listen to it, but if you were to play that with three other guys, it's really difficult.
It's all about tempo too, and having everybody like bring it up, bring it down, bring it up, bring it down, and they do that beautifully in that song. But it is just the same four chords the whole time with just a little I mean, if from a just talent standpoint, if you just said, "Can you do this?" Well, yeah, I think I, but to your point, you put can't. It all together. Yeah, but yeah. I can't.
Yeah, but I can't. Can you do it? Really? Can you do it? Not can you do it? Can you do it?
Great choice.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Matt. You had something to add?
No. I was just saying when I think of that hit and I think of Can You Do It, I also think of the one I love by R.E.M.
Yeah.
For me, musically, because I like playing both these songs on guitar. Like, this is what now had been moving my needle since 85, when I really discovered what I liked and what I liked to play. And this song, like, this is what I like, that on. I there's like an honesty in a way. Like, I don't. Anyway, that's a whole nother topic.
No, I think it's a great point. The thing that I would add to that is Brian, I don't know if you, Todd, you probably know a little bit, but I've been trying to put this Retrophonics group together, which is we're playing stuff in the vein of REM and The Cure and The Smiths and The Church and The Alarm and all this stuff from the 70s and 80s that was really good rock and roll, but people didn't really look at it as rock and roll, because there was so much punk going on and then a lot of other shitty music going on that people loved that they didn't pay attention to anything like this because it just wasn't on the radar. And so I've been trying to find a guitar player for months, and then all of a sudden here comes Matt, and it's like a perfect fit, because this stuff that we're playing in that genre, he's grew up on it, and he just consumes it and eats it every day.
I do.
So thank you. I'm happy we found you.
Yeah, I'm happy to find everybody here. This is beautiful. I could cry.
So let's move on to my song, Dr. Wu, by Steely Dan. Are you with me?
Katie tried, I was halfway crucified. I was on the other side of no tomorrow. You walked in and my life began again. Just when I'd spent the last piastre I could borrow. All night.
Okay, Katie lied. Thoughts?
Oh, I can't say enough about Steely Dan. That's a whole nother topic. We talked about great albums, and Katie Lied is a great album, but I mean, like Asia, obviously, and the Steely Dan, that is a probably one of, let's say, top 100s of all time, if not even in the top 10. Me personally, but I think even like Rolling Stone magazine wise. But Katie Lied, Dr. Wu, Dr. Wu's one of my favorite Steely Dan songs.
This song has always been on my radar. I've always loved this album, and I've been playing a lot of bass lately. My roots in music are a guitar player. I started playing guitar in the late 70s, and just in the past, I've always played bass because I've always been a songwriter recording in my own little home studio, and you need to be able to play a bass to do your own stuff if you're composing. And I've always had a bass, but I've never focused primarily on playing bass in the bands I'm in around town and until the past 3 or 4 months. And so I've been talking to Adam Stone, and Adam's like, why don't you come up and do jazz night with us? And I'm like, man, I'm not a jazz player. Can you play blues? And he's like, we'll figure something out. So I'm like, well, I'm going to sit down and learn some jazz. And of course, I'm not a jazz musician or purist or connoisseur of jazz. So I said, well, Katie Lied has got kind of jazzy. Dr. Wu's kind of jazzy. It's got that piano in it. And so I really didn't realize the greatness of this song until I learned how to play bass to it. And it just, another song, again, like Good Times, Bad Times, where the beginning of it, it's just like, bum, bum. And then it backs off a little bit, and he overlays this Carole King type piano on top of it. Mm-hmm. Like, holy fuck, this is like a sound engineering masterpiece in addition to what a beautiful piece of music it is. And so it just goes back and forth with this powerful dynamic. You don't hear a snare in this song till about the 50 seconds to a minute. And it's just because it's laid back. And then when the snare comes in, and they pick up they don't really pick up the tempo. It's the same tempo, but it sounds like they pick up the tempo because of how they layer the music and how the drums push it. And this song just blows my mind every time now that I listen to it, because I've learned it from the rhythm section. And so I'm getting into the bowels of it and the roots of it, and I can feel it, and it carries me. So this song has been on my radar for 40 years, but it's newly discovered, and that's why I put this one in for me.
Yeah, it's one I really enjoyed. I haven't listened to a lot of Steely Dan lately, so it's kind of good to listen to it again. But you know, Tony, it doesn't surprise me, because you know, when it first starts out, it reminds me of a little bit of an Atlantic Rhythm Section song. And you've reintroduced them back to me, because I remember you were visiting, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and you're like, I'm really into ARS. And I'm like, really? I haven't listened to them forever. So you played some songs. It's like, okay, now I see it. I really see it. Yeah.
Cool. Good to hear.
Yeah, that's interesting you say ARS there, because I like Atlanta Rhythm Section a lot. I think they just have that Allman Brothers sensibility sound to them, is why I like them, even though I never really knew who the band was, because that's the whole thing, right? I mean, they're the Atlanta Rhythm Section, so I never really even knew who the members were. But as far as Steely Dan, I don't have anything to say. I'm woefully ignorant to Steely Dan, and I think it was because it was my dad's music, right? Like, I mean, I'm saying that generically, like, it was just like this. I didn't find the cool factor in it, even though the songs that I knew were catchy and okay enough. What I saw not long ago, though, that made me think, okay, I must have gotten Steely Dan wrong. I must have been missing this one my whole life, is there's a cover band that it's not local. I don't remember the name of their band. It might be this. It's Steal Your Face, but spelled like Steely. And so it was a Steely Dan Grateful Dead cover band. Awesome.
Great.
Where does this come? How does this come together? And when I heard that, I thought,
together. It's a great it's chocolate and peanut butter, baby.
Well, when I knew that I was missing something special when I knew somebody could put those together and it makes sense. And so I still haven't done a dive, but chocolate peanut butter. I like that, Matt.
I would rather, because I'm a dead guy, but I'm a dead from the standpoint that they to me, especially in the 80s, are like a Steely Dan and less like a Fish. So for me, if you're doing the dead and the dead is your base, I would rather go up to the Steely Dan side of the house.
That does make sense to me. Yes.
Steely Dan is another one of those bands that's always been there, you know, and I was sad to see, what was the guy
Becker,
that passed?
Walt Becker
passed recently. You know, they brought a lot of great guitarists in there, like Larry Carrollton plays on some stuff, but people don't realize that was it Becker that was the guitar player. What a fantastic guitar player the guys in Steely Dan were. So, but I think they were masterful songwriters, and I remember I got before the internet, you had to get songbooks, so I got the Steely Dan songbook. And they had these chords called Moo Majors, M-U, Moo Majors. So the Steely Dan invented even chords that called Moo Majors. And you had to be, your fingers were all on a weird contorted position to play a Moo Major. But anyway, Dr. Lou.
Mighty brave man, Tony, mighty brave.
Well, and one last thought on that and the classic rock genres that I did very much get into 60s and 70s rock, and I still do. But I worked in classic rock radio. We're all in Chattanooga here, correct? So we're all familiar with
not Central Illinois.
Okay, Illinois. Home of our Speedwagon, by the way.
Well, you have a classic rock station that sounds just like ours does. And
absolutely.
I got really burnt out on a lot of the staples from Zeppelin, though I went way deeper with them, even Allman Brothers, and just start naming them, and Steely Dan and others. That I didn't get, Santana maybe even, didn't get into. And it's like, all right, this song isn't that good. We got to play it every day? Like, what are we doing?
Right.
And that's not fair to the band. That's not fair to anybody. But that was a reality of it. And I bet that's why I never listened, because Blackjack, do it again. Okay, I don't need to hear that again. I don't need to hear that anymore. So that sometimes taints my overall view of some music that was before my time. Because I'm not I love before my time music. I love it, except for it's hard to make up for 2 decades of lost time, right? So there's going to be a lot left on the table.
So let's wrap up, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Brian. Brian, give you an opportunity to give your podcast a plug before we go.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I call it my almost a dear diary of sorts. It's just my thoughts on things. And I try to focus on local Chattanooga stories and events. It stays away from national topics almost always, not always, but almost always. And it's not weekly anymore. It's a couple times a month. Stone on Air, all one word. You can find the socials. And then I do another thing with Bonnaroo and some music festival talk. It's called the What Podcast too. And that's out there as well. That's a video thing. And it's, I don't even know. I just show up for that one. They just tell me what time to show up and I show up.
That's awesome.
Well, so it's fun. And and thank you for the invite. And I appreciate that. Enjoy talking music.
Yeah, we really appreciate you. I'm very proud to have you on, and I'll be honored to post this content to From the Rooftop, which is Rooftop Music Rehearsal and Music Space podcast. You can find Rooftop Studio at rooftop-music.com. There's another story and why this place is called Rooftop, but you can find that on the website. Matt, local musician, can't wait to play with you again Tuesday night. Town at the end of the month, early beginning of October. So look forward to seeing you when you come to town.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to seeing a little more of the music scene in Chattanooga.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
From the Rooftop Music Podcast is brought to you by Rooftop Music Rehearsal and Recording Studio, Chattanooga, Tennessee. For more information, please visit rooftop-music.com.